Hello, Charlie. Come in, Charlie. We're doing the session on virtual worlds and learning now, so you need to find that PowerPoint. Speaking to the visiting students. Okay. So, little lecture coming up now, I'm afraid. By all means, chip in with questions if you want. Okay. I'm going to take you through some sort of various ideas about virtual worlds and learning, and also throw in some stuff from research projects that Diane and I have done over the last 10 years, really, on virtual worlds. The first set of ideas really comes from this book by Tom Walshdorf, which I think some people may have read last term. It was on our reading list for the research module. No, you didn't read it, did you? Fiona, you didn't read it, did you? Tom Walshdorf, you didn't read that, did you? Okay, this guy's American. Oh, did you read it?
Yeah.
Okay. Do you want to tell us about it?
It's slow then.
Yeah.
No, you
got
it.
Participatory lecture. Okay, Tom Walshdorf, maybe I better do it for Charlie, actually, because I'm by the microphone. So he's an American anthropologist, okay, an ethnographer. So he normally studies societies and groups and cultures. And this book is a kind of ethnography of Second Life. So he spends a lot of time in Second Life, hanging out, thinking about himself as an avatar, meeting other people, investigating them, and trying to give what ethnographers call a thick description, if you like, of the cultures of Second Life. And it's a good book to read. One of the things that he does at the beginning of the book is to say, well, what is a virtual world? I mean, how can we think about a virtual world? How can we kind of define it or conceive of it? Because it's kind of riddled with contradictions. I mean, the whole idea of virtual, you know, what does that mean? And virtual, of course, has to be set against its counter-term, real. So you're immediately stuck with this polarity between virtual life and real life, which seems to have some obvious kind of distinctions, you know, the fleshly, bodily, material world and the world of pixels and representations. But it's not as simple as that. Giorgio? Oh, parallel world, that's nice, yeah. That's very Star Trek. Parallel dimension.
The problem with having a parallel world is emphasis on the geometrical.
Yes. Well, also, it seems to suggest that they're somehow identical.
Exactly.
And they're not, clearly.
That's right.
He begins with this kind of rather nice idea. He goes back to Plato's Republic, you know, the Greek philosopher Plato. And Plato, you may know Plato has this story of a cave. He's trying to think of what the world is beyond this limited fleshly world. It becomes an idea eventually in Christianity. You know, what's the difference between this world we inhabit, this world of this veil of sorrows, and the ideal world of the afterlife, heaven? Okay. So Plato's thinking, he sets up this metaphor of a cave with a fire. And on the wall of the cave, there are thrown the shadows of the real people in the cave. So the real people in the cave are the ideal world, and the shadows are the world we're in now. We live in this world of shadows. Later, we'll get to the real world, the ideal world. And in Christianity, the same idea. We live in a world which is somehow an imperfect shadow of the divine world of God, you know, which we'll eventually get to. Now, curiously, here, the shadow is the fleshly world, and the bodily person is the ideal world. In Second Life, or virtual worlds, it's almost as if it's reversed. You know, the flickering world on the screen is the shadow, and we here, this is the real world of flesh and blood. So it's kind of the other way around there. But it raises an interesting contradiction. You know, can the flickering world be more real than this world in some sense? And it's obviously partly to do with commitment, belief, time spent there and so on. I mean, some people spend such a long time in virtual worlds that it does become very real to them, and the people they meet there, of course, are real. You know, I mean, they're real people at the other end of another computer. It's just as real as having a telephone conversation with someone. So, and people meet each other and get married and all kinds of things. So there's a lot of what we would easily recognise as real being conducted through this meeting. Another way to think about it is a kind of well-known essay by our old friend Michel Foucault, the guy with the great hairdo, which I have a lot of respect for. He's unfortunately not with us anymore, but has anyone read this essay? Foucault's Heterotopia? Okay, it's on the internet, you can find it. It's a good read, it's not very long. Like all of these kind of essays by French philosophers, it's kind of impenetrable in places, but see what you can do. So just to try and, this is rather reductive, but to try and summarise it. Foucault says that a utopia, you know, an ideal world, is an ideal, unreal place. Nobody ever gets to a utopia. It's an unachievable fantasy. It's just a kind of ideal. By contrast, he says a heterotopia. So a kind of topia comes from the Greek word topos, meaning place. Okay, so utopia literally means no place. So it doesn't exist. A heterotopia would be a place of differences. So he says heterotopias are real spaces that exist in every culture. And the defining characteristic of them is they're liminal. They're kind of in between. They're borderline spaces. You know, they're hard to pin down, kind of in between. So they're shifting, they're dangerous, they're hard to get at in some way, hard to pin down. They're transgressive. So his examples of these, places of ritual and taboo, so cemeteries, brothels, colonies, ships. Okay, he's got other examples. Places which are somehow unstable, dangerous, transgressive, risky. Okay, so he's got this up. And it, of course, if you've been in Second Life, you'll know that there are places like that in Second Life. Plenty of them, right? I've never been to a cemetery in Second Life. I was on the ship once. So. And then he, just as if that wasn't complicated enough, he produces this metaphor of a mirror, which is somehow in between. So the mirror kind of is a metaphor for where you stand, you know. So you're not always in these heterotopias. They're places that you may visit or observe from a distance or be aware of or somehow communicate with. And similarly, a utopia you can't go to. You can only see its reflection or its image. You can imagine it or fantasize about it, but it's not real, so you can never go there. So the mirror, he says, from the standpoint of the mirror, I discover my absence from the place where I am, since I see myself over there. Okay, so he sees his reflection, you know. So just think how this works. So if you saw your reflection in the utopia, you could imagine yourself in an ideal world, an ideal version of yourself. So just think about the kind of projection that goes on in gaming roleplay or in virtual world roleplay. You do have ideal versions of yourself, yeah? You know, so when I construct my avatar in Second Life, it's slightly slimmer than I am. I always make my avatar look like me. I'm one of those sad people who has to have an avatar that looks like myself. It's always a bit slimmer, you know, a bit younger. Slightly more cool glasses, you know. So, ideal, you can see how the mirror reflects a kind of utopic, ideal version of yourself. On the other hand, if you see the reflection in the other direction, towards the heterotopia, then you're seeing something different. You're seeing how your avatar would function in a dangerous place. Now, a virtual dangerous place, so this business of the magic circle comes into play. You could go to a dangerous place in Second Life that you wouldn't go to in London, for instance, because you know it's safe, you know you're protected, you're within the magic circle. So virtuality here has that characteristic of, you know, Huizinga's magic circle, or what later theorists have referred to as the psychosocial moratorium. Okay, there's a moratorium on the psychic or social consequences of your actions. So you can do these transgressive things in the virtual world you wouldn't do in the real world. So again, it's a kind of reflection. And it's your avatar again. And your avatar is a reflection of you, in a sense. At least this is me trying to make sense of Foucault, you know. I mean, you may make a different sense of Foucault. So starting from this gaze that is, as it were, directed toward me from the ground of this virtual space that's on the other side of the glass, I come back toward myself. Okay, so that's interesting. You know, so in Second Life you can kind of move the camera around. You know, you start off in a fixed position with your avatar, but you can use the, there are camera controls that you can use in Second Life, so you can move the camera around so that you're looking at your avatar. So, I mean, Foucault wrote this, of course, before Second Life, and I don't think Foucault ever experienced the virtual world, but you can imagine him thinking, wow, oh, fantastic, you know, I can, this game is demonstrating my theory, you know. So you're looking at your avatar, you are seeing your reflection, and the avatar is kind of looking back at you, redirecting your gaze towards yourself. What would that mean? You know, the avatar's saying, well, are you really like this, or do you want to do this, or what shall I do next, master, or, you know, who knows. I come back towards myself. I reconstitute myself there where I am. So there's a question, that question about identity here. I mean, are the identities of these avatars, are they just temporary refuges, or experiments, or fantasies, or do they have a lasting consequence for the way we think about ourselves? If you do something dangerous or transgressive in Second Life, is it going to make you think, are you going to feel guilty permanently? Or are you going to have a different view of yourself? I mean, will something change in the real world? So these seem to be the kind of questions that Foucault's theories ask. So as I say, it's kind of complicated and impenetrable, but it is quite thought-provoking. You know, so have a little think about that if you like the philosophy stuff. Next way of thinking about it, for me, has been drama theory, and I mentioned this earlier. So this guy here is called Jonathan Neelands. He's a professor of educational drama at the University of Warwick. He's one of the great kind of educational drama gurus of the UK, who I have great respect for. And he, again, uses this idea of Augusto Boal, of forum theatre. So, again, as I said before, if forum theatre is where, you know, the normally powerless social actors step onto the stage and take control of the drama or of representations of their lives or their problems, can that happen in a virtual world too? Suppose you get a group in a virtual world. So Second Life is full of groups of people with particular interests. You know. So if you've got a particular kind of issue, could you set up a group in Second Life and meet people there and work it through discussion or role play? Yes, I guess you could. So, you know, this idea of kind of playing a particular role will work there. Which seems this magic circle again, you know, are you protected from the consequences of that or aren't you, is a question. Okay, this is a screen wrap. Is it really a screen wrap? It's a screen wrap. From an online role-playing game called Anarchy Online, which Diane and me explored when we first began doing this project 10 years ago. And it's in the later chapters of the book that you've got. And we spent a while thinking, well, this was our first experience of a massively multiplayer online role-playing game. So we were thinking, well, what does it mean to be an avatar like this, wandering around this world where you can do various things? I mean, you can, here, this is me joining a team to try and go on a mission. Okay, so community of practice kind of work here. This was a community of practice that completely collapsed because they couldn't agree what to do, they couldn't agree who was in charge, and it's like a group of kids kind of, you know, on the playground, sort of failing to agree about everything. So this was a spectacular example of a sort of anti-community of practice who completely failed to go on the mission, you know. Where are you? Yeah, you got lead. Yeah, you're the leader. You sure are stupid. So all the rules of etiquette and so on go about. Well, this is my avatar, by the way. It's called Nirvana. And one of the theories I was thinking about here was Irving Goffman. Have you come across Goffman? He's an American sociologist who wrote this kind of very influential study in the 50s. Which was called The Presentation of Self in Everyday Life. So what he was looking at was, in everyday life, how do people play roles? And he he used the theory of drama and dramaturgy. So he's effectively saying when you go out into the world, what you're doing is playing a role. So if you're a doctor, you know, you go and play doctor role and you put on the white coat and you use a particular voice and you use a special kind of language and you play that role. And his point about it was that it wasn't kind of spectacular. It wasn't like, you know, dressing up as a witch or something. It was ordinary. It was banal. It was routinized, was the word he used. So it's a rather different kind of drama. It's these everyday roles that we play that are so routinized we don't realize we're playing them. You know, we think it's natural, but it isn't actually natural. It's constructed and acquired. And in the same kind of way, you know, you might play a particular role in a role-playing game. You might be a mage or a healer or a warrior or a night elf or whatever else. And these roles kind of seem spectacular to begin with, but if you play the game for a long time, they become kind of ordinary. You become used to them. Again, they become routinized. Another interesting quote which Goffman has in his book is from Jean-Paul Sartre, who said, and Sartre is, I like this story, Sartre is sitting in a cafe in Paris, right, which is what he used to do, you know. You can find the cafe he used to sit in, you can sit there too, on the Boulevard Saint-Germain or wherever. Yeah, have you, anyone been there? Mm-hmm. Sat in Sartre's chair on the pavement. And he's sitting there and he's watching this waiter. And the waiter is doing something funny with a tray, you know, like French waiters do. He's doing some kind of complicated dance with a tray. And Sartre's thinking, what's he doing with the tray? What's going on here? And in the end, he decides that the waiter is just performing the role of waiter. Right? He's performing the role of waiter. That's what waiters do. They do funny things with trays and aprons and money and plates and all the rest of it. And he decides that the waiter in the cafe plays with this condition in order to realise it. So this is what he does every day. He goes out and he realises the role of waiter. And it's fixed, it's settled. Adult roles are kind of fixed and settled. You get used to them, you play them every day, day in, day out, until they become a part of you. They're not something you can really kind of strip off or get rid of and say, well, tomorrow I'm going to be something different. You know, it's your job. Or it's who you are. You think it's who you are. So Sartre thinks, well, how is that different from what children do? And he decides that what children do is something rather different. It's something experimental and provisional. What a child does is play with his body in order to explore it, to take inventory of it. Inventory, a gaming word. So his idea about children is they're much more experimental. They play with these roles. They play with these roles to find out what they can do, to explore the resources, to see what they can do with them, to find out where the pleasures and the profits and the rewards and the challenges and the obstacles are. And of course, that's what kids do. I mean, I've got a nephew who's now sort of 15, but when he was 6, he would wear a different costume every day. You know, day one he'd be Batman with those, you know, those little sort of polystyrene muscles. You know, you get sort of six-pack on the costume made of foam rubber or something. Yeah, you know. And then day two would be Harry Potter in a sort of cloak from Marks and Spencer's with the plastic glasses. Day three he'd be Darth Maul from you know, Star Wars, The Phantom Menace. Day four he'd be Zorro. He had a mask and a little plastic sword with a piece of chalk in the end so he could go Zed all over his mother's furniture. Day five, somebody else. And I remember saying to him one way, you know, he'd wear one of these costumes with a mask, and I remember saying to him one day, oh, it's funny, I haven't seen Dominic. Where's Dominic? And he kind of got very anxious and whipped off the mask and said, I'm here. You know, as if he'd somehow disappeared behind the roles. So playing these roles for children as a kind of temporary experimental fantasy is the norm, and that's what they do. And there's something about these games in which what seems to be possible in virtual worlds or in role-playing games or whatever is for adults who normally are fixed in their roles, the teacher, the doctor, the middle-aged man, the mother, the father, you know, get a chance to do what children do, to play with provisional roles, to explore them, to take inventory of them, to discover the resources in RuneScape, even, and to adopt them or discard them fairly casually as they want. As they wish, to develop a degree of commitment to them or not, as they want. So again, that seemed quite a kind of powerful and suggestive idea to me about the nature of virtual identity. Okay, this is me going shopping in Anarchy Online, shopping for weapons. This was kind of quite a funny episode. This is Diane's avatar, or one of her avatars, a doctor called Graves, and this is me Nirvana. And we met this other guy, right, who was wearing nothing except a thong and a pair of stilettos, right? So I'm kind of complimenting him on his clothes, right? And you can't actually see the provocative thing. I say all the complimentary things about his clothes. And he looks at me and says, "When's it due?" By which he means, you know, you look a bit fat, mate. Because in this game, I had kind of conscientiously decided not to make my avatar too thin out of vanity. I would kind of, you know, represent myself as I am. So I had this slightly kind of portly avatar. So he comes along and says, "When's it due?" You know. And I get unreasonably offended by this. I mean, there's this kind of guy made of pixels insulting my pixelated kind of weight. And I'm unreasonably offended by it. You know, I mean, for all he knew, I might be a really skinny guy in real life. So there was something strange about your investment in the virtual body. You know.
The only one thing about that is that you probably sat on a hammock somewhere in Tahiti about 25 stone.
Yes, exactly. And that's his fantasy, yes.
Because he's not like that.
You're so suspicious.
Cynical.
You're probably so right, yeah. No, exactly. So, but that's the point, isn't it? I mean, it's strange kind of relationship between your physical body and your virtual body, which is either to do with a kind of investment in it because it's like you, or an investment in it because it absolutely isn't like you. It's a fantasy of what you might be in a completely different life. But it's an investment nevertheless. Yeah. Very complicated. But it kind of raises the question of virtual bodies. I mean, embodiment is kind of an interesting thing. You know, is this avatar just, as we were saying earlier about, you know, your avatar in RuneScape, is it just like a little, is it like a playing counter that you just move around to play the game? Or is it like having another body? And up to a certain point, it is like having another body, depending on how committed you are to it. So in Second Life, you can go and buy, I mean, my avatar in Second Life, I've been vain enough to buy a skin. So, you know, you get kind of higher quality skin and, you know, more realistic looking flesh and all the rest of it. And people who are really interested in their bodies can buy genitalia as well, of various sizes, proportions, characteristics and colours. You know, so, and there are whole shopping malls devoted to kind of virtual genitalia. So, the question of the body, and what it is, and why it's interesting, or enabling, or exciting, or erotic, absolutely kind of exists in these virtual worlds, if that's what you're interested in. And it does raise kind of questions about ideologies of the body as well. You know, is this just a reproduction of the kind of body fascism that we endure in real life, where people have to be a particular shape and have to be a particular beauty and all the rest of it? So is your 25 stone guy in Hawaii a victim of kind of body fascism and is having to kind of live that out through this attractive skinny body in the virtual world? Is it just another sort of reproduction of a really quite an old ideological problem? Or is something different going on? World of Warcraft was the next game we looked at, so here is my funny little avatar here, I kind of ruined his call here. I was a very inept mage actually, I just kept getting killed a lot. But, the thing I was thinking here is kind of, well, I'll direct you actually to some writing that Diane and Martin Oliver at the Knowledge Lab have done about this, because they looked at communities of players in World of Warcraft in relation to the theory of communities of practice I was talking about, and decided actually that, you know, there were kind of anti-communities of practice in World of Warcraft forums, you know, people who did not behave like communities at all, fragmented and collapsed. So it was an attempt to look quite kind of sceptically at these rather glowing notions of communities that you sometimes hear in rhetorics about new media and virtual worlds. So I guess the message is it pays sometimes to be a bit sceptical about the big claims that are made for community and identity and learning, actually, as well. You know, there are some very big, very sort of excessive rhetorics about the kind of value, potential, meaning of virtual worlds, games, and new media in general. And it pays sometimes to be a bit sceptical. Okay, Second Life. this is a video, I hope, from this course a few years ago. Where, and we will do this, we will go and visit Second Life in a few weeks' time, okay? So I have to set you up. You have to download Second Life. Who's got Second Life already? Hooray! Okay, so the rest of you, you've got to download Second Life, okay? It's free, but it does take a long time to download at home on your desktop computer. So just, you know, set it up one afternoon and leave it and go and have some coffee or do something. Come back, and when it's downloaded, get into it, create an avatar, and get, you know, I mean, you'll be dressed, you'll have clothes, you can change your clothes. You'll have an inventory with a sort of little wardrobe in it, so you can sort of change what you look like a bit. Develop an avatar. You'll have to have a name when you go in there. So you can begin all that, and then we'll meet up in Second Life and have a conversation about Second Life as a sort of learning world. So I'll tell you the story of this. This was the MA group, as I said, a few years ago. Jelly Bella, that's Diane's avatar. Here's mine, Juniper Matt. That's me sitting down there. And then there are various other people. Okay, so they just arrived in Second Life, in the place where we decided to meet. But there was one guy who we couldn't see. He seemed not to have got there. And in fact, he's up here. We couldn't see him because he's sitting on top of this lampshade. This guy who called himself Chupo Umaga. And the interesting thing about him is he was a very, very shy, obedient Indian student. And his learning identity, if you like, his learning role in class was always to sit at the back, to never ask questions, and to write down everything the teacher said. That was what he did. He was one of those very, very obedient students. Okay, so we get here, we can't see him, he's sitting on top of the lampshade, and then this happens. You may miss this because it happens quite quickly. So we're all sitting around, and we're sort of, you know, one of them's trying to work out how to sit down here, because that's, she's got a Mac and she has a little right button, and you have to right click to sit down, so there's another way of doing it, she can't work out how to do it. So we're all sort of just getting settled down and trying to use the furniture. Yeah. And then she's still trying to sit down. Diane is giving people sort of helpless ideas. This gives you some idea of the challenges of holding a meeting in Second Life, you know, sitting down on the furniture. And I'm typing, yes, indeed, I'm trying to join in the conversation. Oh, did you see that?
Yeah.
What was that?
Something being thrown.
Did you see what it was? There's Jerry Heller going, oh, what was that? Okay, well, you may not see it again. So, what it was a knife. Did anyone spot it? Okay, so, Chupo Umaga, the kind of obedient, polite, shy Indian student, had discovered this animation in Second Life where you could throw knives at people. So he's sitting on top of the lampshade throwing knives at me and Diane, his teachers, when he's supposed to be attending a virtual seminar in Second Life, okay? So,
Can you virtually
exclude him? Well, it didn't hurt us because it's virtual bodies, you know. There's a difference, you know. So we're protected by the magic circle. So we kind of thought about this for a while, and we talked to him afterwards about it, and I mean, clearly one thing that was happening was that this persona that he normally used in face-to-face seminars had completely been abandoned in a virtual world. He felt it was okay there to be the class idiot, to be transgressive, to be violent, to adopt the kind of learning style that was kind of on the edge of, you know, insanity, sort of disobedience. And then in other sessions afterwards, he carried this, he didn't ever throw knives again, but he would ask disruptive questions in the middle, of difficult questions that he knew were going to kind of cause people trouble. He'd disagree with people, he'd be contentious and rude and, you know, completely different learning style. I mean, very productive actually, because it, in a different kind of way, he learned things differently and he contributed differently to the class, and he was a dynamic element in a way that he wasn't in face-to-face seminars. So, you know, something about this kind of idea of playing a role. He's clearly playing a role here that is not his settled. If you go back to, Sartre, he had this rather settled student role, you know, which he couldn't get out of. He always had to be the obedient, quiet student. But something about the game environment that has said to him, it's okay to experiment, it's not real, it's not permanent, you know, you're not kind of stuck with this forever, this kind of Mexican Day of the Dead skull that he decided he would wear as a head, you know. I mean, you wouldn't come into a seminar wearing a Mexican dead skull. So different rules apply, kind of carnivalesque rules of behaviour. And it was that kind of temporariness, you know, that Sartre's child experiences. It's okay to experiment, to adopt these things for fun, and so on. It's also because he perceived it to be a gaming culture. And it turned out he was an experienced player of the shooting game Counter-Strike, which he played in LAN cafes with friends of his in India. And his avatar name here, Chupo, turned out was a nickname he'd been given when playing Counter-Strike because he once turned around and shot his ally, and kind of deliberately. And somebody turned around to him and said, oh, that was a cheap shot. And from then on, he was known as Chupo the Cheap Shot, you know. So he gave himself a name from gaming culture, from Counter-Strike, which is associated with transgressive behaviour, you know, messing about, clan, and being irresponsible. And that sort of somehow got fused with his identity as a student. So it was kind of interesting, but quite extreme. So this is him talking about it. Came from Counter-Strike, we were playing Counter-Strike, I killed someone I wasn't supposed to kill, and I didn't know for it. I did it deliberately, it was a cheap shot. Okay, we went on various other trips and so on, and we interviewed people, so we had some kind of quite interesting discussions. Another thing that we did, which was again interesting, was we had a visiting lecturer from South Africa. So she is Chupo again, still wearing his Mexican Day of the Dead head. I don't think you can see the lecturer. Anyway, she's a lecturer from the University of Cape Town. So she said, I'll come and do a lecture for you on World of Warcraft, where she is a guild leader. And she came and she developed this area in Second Life for us to kind of meet on, and she had a screen where she could project her PowerPoint display. So there were some sort of interesting questions about whether what's going on in a virtual meeting. You said you've been to a conference in Second Life recently. How is it different or similar from two real work, real life conferences? I should have introduced you.
It was somehow easier to present because there were enough people watching me in real life. It was easier somehow.
Yeah.
Because I'm a little bit shy to present.
So some of those problems of kind of embarrassment or meeting new people don't exist in the same kind of way for the first time. Yeah. Okay. So there's the role gives you a kind of protection. The avatar gives you a kind of social protection. Okay. And also, I mean, you can fantasize. People can turn up in fantasy outfits. I mean, another project I did was with a teacher who had an after-school class in Teen Second Life where she made animations out of Second Life, Machinima. Do you know Machinima? Phil nodded. Do you want to
I don't know if I can explain, I've just sort of
come across it. Yeah. It's basically what happens if you make a film out of a game, alright? It started off, again, about 12 or 13 years ago, with people taking computer games they played and exporting gameplay sequences as film So they would meet up with people, act out a role, have a script and everything, capture it, export it, edit it, put music on it and so on, and make a film out of it. So it's like making an animation out of a game environment. And of course, you can do it with Second Life. I mean, you can meet up here and say, you know, he's going to be Hamlet and I'm going to be Claudius, and we'll do the script and we'll perform a bit of Hamlet and we'll capture it, and then we'll edit it and we'll maybe put voiceover dubs on it and we'll put music on it and you'll have an animated film of Hamlet. So that's a machinima. But I mean, the point is, the students who she was doing this with in Second Life, it was like an after-school club in many ways. I mean, they turned up voluntarily, they agreed to do some work, etc., etc. But they turned up as marshmallows and top hats, and, you know, there's something different about being able to turn up in an outrageous costume in a way that you never would here, or you never would in a school classroom, that makes some kind of difference. Not sure. Okay, here are some sort of comparisons, you know, classroom and Second Life. What are some of the differences? Trying to do this in a kind of tabular form. Classrooms, privilege language, Second Life, virtual world, privilege action. Real life consequences, you know, if we do something, there is a kind of continuing consequence. In the virtual world, maybe we're protected by the role. The role and the self appear to be fused in real life. You know, Sartre's waiter, I mean, we think we are the roles that we play, though we aren't. Whereas here, the role is very distinct from the self and can be provisional, can be adopted, can be discarded. Ethnicity and gender are fixed. You know, you can't turn up in this class as a woman, unless you're being Lara Croft, of course. You can't decide you're going to turn up as a white guy if you're a black guy, or vice versa. But in the virtual world, you can do that. It's quite, you know, so it's quite hard to tell whether people really are the gender that they appear to be, or even the ethnicity. The self is routinized in this role. You know, you're playing the person you're used to playing every day, whether it's student or whatever. This may be a bit different, of course. I mean, if you're normally a teacher or an IT worker or a computer programmer, and you become an MA student, and you arrive for your first seminar, well, that is a bit different, isn't it? I mean, you're close enough to this to remember it. How does it feel? You get to the seminar and you are being a different person, right? Does it feel different? Does it feel as if you're playing a different role? When you stop being a head of department or an IT coordinator or whatever, and you're on the receiving end of my kind of pedagogic act, does it feel different? What's the difference? What kind of role are you playing? Is there a shift in power, for instance? I mean, compared with your normal lives.
Well, that first came to being a teacher every day. This was about
you're in trouble.
Yeah. So obviously, being sitting to IT, obviously, quite anxious. But my first day here, obviously, you're right, out of education for so long, it was kind of like remembering to be a good student and a couple of when I was younger.
Yeah.
Listening and writing, so
it's a sort of retro recapturing of your younger self. To play the role of student. So I mean, they're not kind of as routinized as we sometimes think they are. I mean, they change, don't they? But nevertheless, I mean, as adults, normally we're routinized into our roles, and here not. And we can adopt spectacular roles in a way that it's hard to do. We can say, "I'm going to be Mexican Day of the Dead knife thrower," and it kind of works. Monolocational, we're kind of stuck here, multi-locational. So, you know, if we decided that we now want to go and visit an animation studio, well, we can't do it, do we? We can't just kind of go and, you know, it would take me a week to go and organise it, and then everyone would have to meet there and get the bus, and it would be endless effort. We went to visit an animation studio, Machinima Studio, with the MA students in Second Life, and it took 5 seconds to get there. We just transported and we were there, you know, went to the address. So you can move, you can do school trips instantly in a virtual world in a way that's very difficult And you don't have to be in an educational setting. I mean, the other decision we had in using Second Life as a learning environment is, do we do what some universities do, which is buy an island with a university building so that we end up in a place that's really very like this place, but in Second Life? And we decided, no, we won't do that. We'll just kind of sit on the grass, you know, to become like being a hippie again. And where you realise that, learning spaces don't have to be seminar rooms, they can be cinemas or parks or whatever, which is kind of interesting in some ways. I mean, we did get interrupted a lot by sort of weird people running through, you know, trying to join in, but it does raise some interesting questions about kind of places and spaces of learning. Fixed teacher roles, so like these routinized roles, the teacher role is fairly kind of fixed in some ways, much more fluid perhaps in a virtual world. I don't know that. Pretty heavy sort of roadmap, you know, you don't get too many digressions in these conventional seminars because we're trudging through my PowerPoints, you know. Digression is kind of more tolerated in the virtual world, perhaps. I'm not sure about that either, because you can get very regimented sessions in Second Life as well. High coherence, well, I'm not sure about that in the real world. Very coherent. Sometimes experiences in virtual worlds can be quite incoherent. Don't know what that means, can't remember what that means. Okay. We also did some comparisons between, because these were like you, some of them were full-time students and some were distance students. So the other experience of learning was the VLE, which then was Blackboard and now you've got Moodle. So that was the other comparison. You know, how is a virtual world like or not like a conventional virtual learning environment like Moodle? Okay, the most obvious one was that the VLE is asynchronous and it's synchronous, so you're all there at your time. And that actually accounts for a lot of the apparent benefit of it. You know, you feel you're talking to someone. I mean, you could be having a conference phone call, actually, would have the same effect, so you have to be a bit careful about this apparent characteristic. It's not exclusively a characteristic of virtual worlds. But synchronicity is important. Monomodal, in other words, the VLE is mostly about writing some pictures. And this is multimodal, so it can be about gesture, it can be about voice, it can be about imagery and so on. The VLE, low visibility, ethnicity and gender, you really can't tell about people's ethnicity or gender, except from names, and even there sometimes it's hard to tell. In Second Life it's marked, but it may be fictitious. Low definition of role, you don't really play a role on the VLE. In some senses you do. You might still be playing the obedient student or the questioning student or whatever it might be. But the role is much more markedly defined in Second Life. Privileged language, privileged action, routinized role, spectacular role. So these other things are quite similar to the difference between virtual worlds and face-to-face. And then we interviewed people, got quite different kind of reactions to this. So this student, who's full-time, she preferred real life and the VM. She didn't really like Second Life, she thought it was pointless. Actually, she thought it was like doing a lot of typing, interestingly, because you were using text chat. So she felt she was just reading and writing, actually. I mean, she had this avatar, and she had these lovely environments and all the rest of it, but she wasn't really looking at that. She was reading the text, and she was typing in, and she found it in effort. She said it's just like doing a lot of reading and writing. Okay. This guy, who was in America, a part-time student, was gobsmacked by it compared with the VLE. And he said, you know, with Blackboard, I feel like I post my kind of essay on the board and nobody looks at it for 2 weeks. With this, I feel as though I'm sitting next to you, even though I'm, you know, 3,000 miles apart. So for him, it was kind of transformative. So it kind of depends who you are, what you're used to, and, you know, what you prefer, doesn't it? This is me with a PhD student in Second Life. Some advantages, some disadvantages. I mean, here the roles are much more routinized, you know, it's not like being the Mexican Day of the Dead guy. It's really just like us being ourselves, meeting in various places, my little house in Second Life. And having a talk about the PhD. So this for me feels much closer to having ordinary supervision, actually quite banal, it's quite routinized. There's nothing particularly spectacular about it. But there are some differences. Linguistic differences partly. I mean, hesitation is an interesting thing when you're text chatting. If it was a phone call or Skype and somebody stopped talking for a minute, it would you'd think they'd gone offline or something, or there was some big problem. But if somebody pauses here in the text chat, it's normal. It's kind of okay. You know that they're just preparing themselves or typing the next bit, and you just wait. So there's actually more room, in a way, for people to reflect and think slowly as they go through the conversation than in real life or Skype, for instance. Okay. I'll just finish, I think, with this example. This is the person I was talking about earlier who ran the class in Second Life. She's an animator from Norfolk. And she had this class of kids who met in the teen grid. You know, Second Life has, or used to have, I think it's now changing. Is the teen grid going into in Second Life? You know? The teen... Is it being changed or stopped or something? It's stopped. There was a teenage area that was protected, you know, for children. You had to have a CRB check and everything to enter it as an adult. So she ran this course, and the point was the kids would drop in and they would make machinima films. So the question for us here was, how is this like or not like a face-to-face class in a school or an after-school class? It's media education, so how is it like or not like making films and animations in ordinary media classrooms? Okay? So the media teachers speak about that. Okay, so some ways of thinking about... Okay, so this is a worksheet that she did for them. So you can see in many ways it's quite conventional. You've got people being actors and actresses, so some kids are acting, someone's a director, someone's a cameraman, somebody had to get the sound, and so on. So in some ways it's very like conventional media practice. And one of the things that she did to learn how to make machinima was she went into Second Life seminars run by professional machinima or experienced machinima makers from this first generation who made them 10 or 12 years ago. She learnt the skills there. And a lot of the talk in those seminars is very familiar if you're a media teacher. You know, they'll say, you know, what editing software do you use? And, you know, how do you get the lip syncing right? Oh, I use this software, you know. And, you know, what about the soundtrack? And how do you render it? You know, so you get all this kind of techie discussion that's very, very familiar to sort of media teachers and amateur video producers, I guess, as well. So in some ways, it's kind of tapped into quite well-established conventional traditions of media production and media teaching. But there are differences, okay? I mean, the cameraman is floating up in the air, for instance, and he can actually get any angle he wants. Well, you can't do that in an ordinary media classroom, yeah. You're pretty well... You can't do a crane shot, you know? You haven't got the crane. But in Second Life, you can, because you can fly. The sort of avatar-based role-play is different because you can play these roles, you can change your body shape and all the rest of it in ways that you wouldn't be able to do in real life. I don't know. It's kind of like and not like, but there is a The other thing she decided is that the classroom was different, because she had been a media teacher in a school and an art teacher. She didn't, she got out of school because she couldn't stand the noise. She said, "You can just keep shouting all the time, you can never keep them quiet, it's very, very stressful, you know what it's like." Now, she said two contradictory things about second life. She said, first of all, she said it's very noisy. And what she meant was they were always talking, But the talking was text chatting. And the text chatting orders itself, of course, in order. So you can read it as it scrolls through, and you can go back and look at it again if you want. So it's retrievable and it's orderly. It's not like kids do, you can't talk over each other, in other words, in Second Life. It's always going to have to queue up. And also, it's silent. So although she said it was noisy, she just meant they were talking a lot. She then said, "It's what I like about it is it's so quiet." So she had this really quiet environment with kids' comments stacking up in an orderly way in the text chat. Quite different kind of classroom dialogue. Okay, well, we ended up in the end saying the virtual worlds were ambiguous, which I think is a bit of a cop-out, really, but, you know, you have to make a decision. But here are some of the types of ambiguity. So, back to Foucault, is it utopic, is it an ideal world, or is it heterotopic, is it a dangerous, risky, transgressive, real space? Are we immersed in it, are we detached from it, this business of role distance? Is it a community or is it an anti-community? Is it chaos or is it democracy? Is it both order or chaos? Is it work or play? You know, so you think of my student kind of going in there and throwing the knife. For him, what was normally a work-like experience of being an MA student became a play-like experience of being an MA student. Is it a world? Or is it actually just a platform? And some people think of Second Life and virtual worlds, Second Life particularly, as a 3D version of the web. Because you can, if you want to go to places or find things, you can type a search in, it'll find the address, and you can go to the address. So you go to the shop where you want to buy leather jackets. I mean, in a way, it's just like Googling it and going to the online shopping site. But it's a 3D version, and you can walk around the store. So is it really just a 3D version of the internet? And are you learning through it? The media studies question, or are you learning about it? Or both? And if you were learning about it in media education, media studies, what would you want to teach students about virtual worlds? Would be the question. Oh. That's me playing my accordion. It only plays two tunes. Tune called the Blackthorn Stick. It's interesting. It only plays two tunes. It's completely pathetic. But then, right. Okay, let's stop there. Any questions or kind of comments about any of that? Oops.